Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Daniel Butler. Coming up on The Wire today.
So it's designed, as in fact the ones in the sovereign states are, as a mechanism of oversight for the government.
Bill Shorten fronted the National Press Club today to announce, among other things, the intention to set up a National Integrity Commission, much like state anti-corruption bodies. Also coming up on The Wire...
Democratization doesn't necessarily lead to the improvement of human rights, but in Indonesia's case, it gives more power to religious conservatism.
This past weekend, in the Indonesian province of Aceh, several beauty salons run by transgender women were raided by police. Indonesia's queer community has been continually marginalised by politicians and religious leaders. And as the government tries to legislate against their rights, many are wondering if this is a sign things are going to get worse. Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on The Wire. Today, Bill Shorten announced at the National Press Club that he would institute a new federal corruption watchdog with Royal Commission powers within 12 months of taking office. Many have been calling for this for years after expenses, scandals and rorts have focused a need to shine a light on the dark corners of government and the public sector. Roderick Chambers asked the University of Technology's Associate Professor of Politics, Policy and Applied Ethics, Bly Graham, whether this National Integrity Commission would be like the state anti-corruption watchdogs.
Well, it's very similar in the sense that it would be, putatively speaking, Bill's, the opposition leader's National Integrity Commission would be a commission of investigation, so it doesn't involve a court of law. So it would have fairly serious powers of investigation, those equivalent to a royal commission, which is about as serious as it gets in this country. But nevertheless, it would only have the authority to investigate and to make recommendations to the Department of Public Prosecution. So it's similar to all of the statutory organisations that currently exist in the states, the sovereign states, and also the Northern Territory. They've all got one. They're all a little bit different, but they all do more or less the same thing.
Why do you think we haven't had one in federal parliament before?
That's an excellent question. I think it's because we've always had the ability, Parliament's always had the ability to call a royal commission, and it's done that on many occasions since its inception. And a royal commission at a federal level is just as thoroughgoing and as cogent and as morally defensible as they are at the state level as well. So that's always been the go-to in terms of addressing these kinds of issues if they're regarded as systemic. We've always had that lever or that button, I suppose, but setting up a permanent statutory authority under the auspices or the guidance or the responsibility to the Australian Federal Parliament is taking it one step further, and I think that's very important to note.
Because it sounds a bit like it's having a permanent royal commission on hand, but it does say it's only for the public sector, so that wouldn't cover something like the Banks Royal Commission coming up now, would it?
No, absolutely not. So it's designed, as in fact the ones in the sovereign states are, as a mechanism of oversight for the government. So if you have a look at, for example, the one in Western Australia is called the Western Australian Corruption and Crime Commission. So it's auspiced with looking at the activities of government and its ancillary bodies. And similarly with all the other, I mean, I could rattle off the names, but they're all more or less the same in terms of their auspice. So the federal government nevertheless would have the power to call a royal commission, for example, as it has done into any particular issue that it so desires. And the example that they've used is into the banking sector. So yes, it would exist aside from the power of royal commissions.
So do you think we'd see a few less royal commissions, or it just would add to the investigations going on?
Me to say, but we probably wouldn't see less royal commissions because a royal commission is extremely serious. So if you're looking at systemic problems in a particular sector, then that lever is reached for. This is more an oversight mechanism. Okay, so it's investigative, but it's continual. So royal commissions are normally only used when there is great, I suppose, a degree of moral worrying about what's going on in a particular sector, and the banking sector is a very good example. The ones that we had in Queensland and in New South Wales, the Fitzgerald Inquiry and the Woods Royal Commission into the respective best and fairest, quote-unquote, of those states at that time in the 80s are very similar examples. The other point as well is that it's important to recognise, I think, from a more strategic level, that this really is a move away from the reliance in the last, I suppose, two decades on codes of conduct, for example, ministerial codes of conduct. So, what, you know, if we've got any, the way that we address problems of misdemeanors or perhaps systemic corruption is we get people to sign a little piece of paper saying they're going to be good boys and girls, and then we get on with the rest of our lives. This is a little bit different, and is representative of a swing away from the self-policing mode to more traditional oversight mechanism.
And there's been a few leaks going around from ministers' files recently in the sphere of asylum seekers and what have you. Do you think Bill Shorten's on a bit of a winner here with this commission, do you think, politically?
Well, I think that's a very good point, is that it's a very, in a way, it's quite an easy card to play politically, because you're playing the law and order card, but you're also playing it against politicians and the state. So in that sense, if one was profoundly cynical, one might say that it's a political winner for the leader of the opposition and a way to increase the profile of the opposition.
Dr. Bly Grant, Associate Professor of Politics, Policy and Applied Ethics at the University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report. Yesterday, a summit was created which invites Beijing and Seoul to Tokyo for the first time since 2015. Reception to the summit globally has been positive, but history might record otherwise. Hans Lee found out why these three unlikely partners may reach agreement and what part Australia could have in the rapprochement.
Yesterday, a summit was called for Japan, China and South Korea, their first since 2015. And while that might be a sign of improved relations between the North Asian neighbours, Japan-China and Japan-Korea relations have always been volatile. Public opinion, particularly in both China and Japan in the post-war world, has been at times frustrating, with business leaders, conservatives and politicians all clashing heads over who should deal with the relationship and how it might work. As Japan academic Sheila A. Smith noted in her book Intimate Rivals, Japan's policy-making experience demonstrates that while the choice of strategy has remained in the elite, there is increasing societal pressure for more lukewarm relations. But we should never forget the overarching problem. China and Japan's problems in particular are decades old, and positive effects of talks are often limited. So is it time for a third broker to step in? Like Australia. I spoke to Tim Harcourt, the airport economist, and he gave me his comments on what he thinks will happen.
China, Japan and Australia having a strong relationship in the Asia-Pacifics allowed China to also join the Asia-Pacific community and be a leader. And in a sense, I think it's been a good contributor to stability in the region economically.
Do you think, at least economically then, that Australia could be a nice middleman, I guess, between China and Japan if they ever decide, let's sort out our differences? I know they've just called a summit for China, Japan and Korea. What's your take on that?
I don't know if we'll be the diplomatic broker, but we certainly could be one of a number of powers making a positive contribution. I know that Australia and South Korea set up APEC and set up the G20 infrastructure during the global financial crisis. So I think there is a role for middle powers to make a positive contribution when things go a little bit off of the wheels for the superpowers.
Tim Harcourt, the airport economist, ending that report by Hans Lee. Over the weekend, police in the conservative Indonesian province of Aceh raided several beauty salons run by transgender women. In the last several years, Indonesia's queer community has become increasingly vilified by politicians, religious leaders and the wider community. As legislators draft significant changes to the criminal code, many are asking if things are only to get worse. Earlier today, I asked Hendry Yulius, research associate from Sydney University's Indonesian Studies Department, about the proposed changes.
Since 2016, There has been a number of efforts to criminalize LGBT people or homosexual identity or also homosexual practices. And then last year, an Islamic pro-family group proposed the amendment of the criminal code to include consented same-sex relation as a crime. But the Constitutional Court rejected that proposal, arguing that the responsibility should be with the House of Representatives, not with the Constitutional Court. So now the ball is heading to the House of Representatives. But at the same time, we are also witnessing the increasing attempts from those conservatives to keep pursuing these legal changes. So criminal code is one thing. We still have, for example, the broadcasting law to purge LGBT-related content from television.
So what is the likelihood of them actually passing into law?
Well, it's unpredictable, I have to say. But after the incident of the arrest of transgender women in Aceh, I have been personally witnessing the increasing politicization of these issues by local and national politicians. So if this politicization worked, it's more likely that they can pass it into law.
So if the laws pass, how could life change for Indonesia's queer community?
Okay, so this is also very ambiguous and quite difficult to pin down, because how do you accuse people of being a homosexual unless you see them showing affections or having sex in front of you, right? So in a way that what I am worrying now is that the primary marker of LGBT people is going to be signified through their gender non-normativity. For example, men with female feminine mannerisms or transgender women. So they might be easily arrested because they are very visible.
On a number of fronts, Indonesia has become increasingly hostile to LGBT people, specifically in the last few years. Why now? Especially in what has historically been a comparatively liberal Muslim nation.
There are multiple elements here. The first important thing is the democratization of Indonesia since 1998 has led to the rising religious conservatism in the country. Democratization doesn't necessarily lead to the improvement of human rights, but in Indonesia case, ironically, it gives more power to religious conservatism to influence public and political spheres. That's number one. Number two, the issue of LGBT identity and rights have also been globalized and internationalized within this time frame. So, you know, like same-sex marriage in the U.S. was legalized in 2015, and it also caused uproar. And after that, LGBT issues also became national attention, creating national crackdown over LGBT Indonesia. And this is also because, yeah, the increasing visibilities of LGBT issues, the globalization of LGBT issues and marriage equality, which then gives political capital for the religious conservatives to politicize it, yeah, through the moral panic.
Speaking about our neighbour, one of our nearest neighbours, what does it mean for Australia having a nation so nearby that is turning away from internationally recognised human rights?
Well, in Australia, we Yes Vote won last year. And this is a groundbreaking move for Australia. But I believe that marriage equality is not the end and shouldn't be the end of queer movements. So now I think we have to also feel more concerned about Indonesia and also take refugees, particularly queer refugees issues, very, very importantly. Yeah, I'm quite worried that queer refugees can become another important issue for Australia.
Research Associate Henry Julius from the University of Sydney ending that report. The government continued its New Year announcements with today's Innovation Report, which seemed to also tie in with the new defence export strategy for military hardware that it announced yesterday. This report has been touted as Innovation 2.0, the second generation. And Roderick Chambers asked UTS Associate Professor Danielle Logue just how much substance there was behind the hype.
Well, we certainly needed something to go beyond the hashtag ideas boom, and it is good to see the government putting innovation and science to an extent back on the table and thinking about how do we better organise for innovation across different sectors.
I think Dr. Ferris was quite interested in the export capabilities as a way to economic growth. Is there anything new in this, though?
I think we have focused on export capabilities for many years now. We have a lot of support through our traditional Austrade services. The issue that we found in researching high-growth firms across the country is actually finding talent for them. So it's not accessing the markets that's an issue, it's the talent back here in Australia that they need to grow and scale their business. It is the challenge for them.
I was listening to Christopher Pine, I think yesterday, explaining that banks were perhaps not the best people to finance new innovative projects for defence. And he suggested that's why the government should be involved. Is this the way we've always done it?
I think this is a really important point, Rod, and something that stuck out to me in the report, that the emphasis is on relying on the business sector to drive investment in research and development. And the report looks at the government's not really increasing R&D expenditure, mainly by 0.01%, and it's relying on business investment in R&D to increase from 1% to about 1.7% of GDP. And we know, as Christopher Pine says, that business just doesn't take that deeper investment in R&D. We know from Apple, we know from Tesla, big corporations, that a lot of those moonshot ideas and the deep science that we even find in our iPhone comes out of government-funded R&D that wouldn't have happened if we were relying on business to take that early-stage risk in the scientific process.
I mean, a lot of the R&D funding sort of went through tax cuts and things. But that kind of assumes that you're making money to start with, which is often the wrong way round for when you're coming up with something new, isn't it?
That's right. What is missing in this document is that first level of scientific research that all economies really rely on and that businesses rely on to then commercialise and have products and services coming out of that. So we're not seeing any increase in that funding there. There's no emphasis on science, and this also kind of flies in the face of the impending university cuts that we're expecting to in R&D. So if we don't have a focus on, you know, university research, scientific research, our CSIRO, our national agencies there, there's not that capability to then look at how business can then commercialise and take it on from there. There's a problem in our pipeline.
And I think Christopher Pine in his previous portfolio of education was quite keen on STEM subjects, which I think the S stands for science, doesn't it?
It sure does. And I think we've missed our science minister is now out of the main cabinet as well. So it's kind of conflicting priorities that are going on here. But I do think it's a weakness to just think that an innovation capability for the nation can rely on business, increasing business investment in R&D. And still what we have here as our main policy for that is the R&D tax incentive for business R&D. We do have in the new document a focus on national missions and being the healthiest country in the world to start have some focus there. Now, whilst I applaud having this idea of mission-oriented innovation policy, and that's been a lot of the work that's coming out of the UK and Europe at the moment, you've got to have that funded, actually. Otherwise, it's a little bit of an ideas boom again.
Yes, because, I mean, it is if you're wanting to start exporting somewhere or to open up a new market in the traditional sense, it is good to have, you know, someone on the other side of the world that is a friendly face, that has an office, that it's somewhere where you can sort of land on, a landing pad.
That's right.
We've had that in the past, but are you saying that they've all been scaled back?
No, I think we still have that. We still have our Austrade and Aus Industry and our services programs like that. We also have the entrepreneurial launch pads for startups where Aussie startups can go into Berlin, for example, and have 2 weeks of a free co-working space if you get into particular programs there. So,
Is that working well in your experience?
I think that the launch pads are a good way for startups to gain entry into those markets, but often startups at those early stages, they're still trying to work out what they're actually doing. What I was hoping we would see more of is that focus on missions and actually the government picking areas that we are going to have some deep long-term investment in, which then different industries can get behind. So you have that security of knowing this is where Australia's going, these 10 particular areas, this is what we're going to be known for, and we're going to invest in that and be globally competitive.
Dr. Danielle Logue, Associate Professor of Management Discipline Group at the University of Technology Sydney, there ending that report. The Native Title Act is the recognition by Australian law that Indigenous people have rights and interests to their land that come from their traditional laws and customs. Just before the Invasion Day protests that took place around the country on January 26th, Sherry Sufi, the chairman of the WA Liberal Party Policy Committee, claimed that native title can only exist if Australia was settled, not invaded. Miles Herbert asks if calling January the 26th Invasion Day really undermines native title.
Is that true?
It is not true.
This is Associate Professor Kate Galloway from Bond University responding to an opinion piece penned by Sherry Sufi, the chairman of the WA Liberal Party, who said native title can only exist if Australia was settled, not invaded.
It's not correct as a question of law.
Why?
Originally, lands were only deemed to have been settled if they didn't have any people there. So literally, that's that terra nullius idea that we hear about. So terra nullius in its literal sense means land belonging to no one. So originally, as a question of logic, if there are no people there, there are no pre-existing laws and no law relating to ownership of land.
And Galloway says this idea of terra nullius just doesn't apply to Australia.
We know that that is not actually true. We know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have been resident here for, now we know it's over 65,000 years, but and that they are peoples with sophisticated systems of laws and that they were sovereign peoples over this country.
So in stepped the High Court, who in 1992 established native title to recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' property rights to Australian land that existed when the English took possession of them in 1788.
So the court said, look, we can't go back on this settlement thing. It's too late. It's too late to go back on that. But what we will do is we'll create a new Australian law that says that if the place was settled but inhabited, then the pre-existing land law will apply. That is, we will recognise the ownership of land that existed at the time Australia was colonised.
And Gaynor MacDonald, anthropologist at the University of Sydney, says when we think about native title, we do have to go all the way back to the fact that Australia was invaded.
Well, it does start with the fact that the country has been, and of course this is the current debate, invaded.
And questions about this fact make MacDonald laugh.
No, that's nonsense.
MacDonald says native title laws are kind of a case of the British government wanting to have its cake and eat it too. They recognise the rights of Indigenous Australians claimed to their land, but they also continue to deny this country was invaded. So do you think that the Mabo decision and native title kind of destroys the idea of terra nullius?
This is another legal fiction, if you like. Of course, by saying that there were pre-existing land laws, it denied terra nullius. So if they deny that they invaded by force, which they continue to do formally, then in fact terra nullius still exists.
MacDonald thinks the only reason native title is even back in the spotlight is because we are still so soon after Invasion Day protests across this country.
The resistance to recognising Australia's history and the pre-existing rights of Indigenous people in Australia, it remains intense in Australia.
For MacDonald, this conversation comes down to one thing, an attempt to whitewash Australia's history.
It is definitely a whitewashing of history, and Australia must be one of the only countries that doesn't face up to its history. That is why I think that Indigenous people continue to constitute a threat. That's what this politics is really about, because if they did acknowledge that history, you know, there's some very, very big changes, much, much bigger than tinkering with native title.
That was Dr. Gaynor MacDonald, ending that report by Miles Herbert. That's it for The Wire today. The Wire is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Daniel Butler. Thanks for your company.
Around Australia, you're tuned into community radio.